Welcome back to Designing for Windows Phone 201. I'm Jared Potter, and right now, last section we talked about the system, next we'll be talking about composition, and then we'll be talking lastly about controls and API. This is composition, let's jump right in. So I've broken composition up into three different departments. There's visuals, there's layouts, and then on Windows Phone, we're big and heavy on motions and transitions. We love motion and transition as well as the visuals. One of the biggest pieces of the visuals for Windows Phone that everybody sort of realizes and talks about is that customization piece. How beautiful it is and how you can really reorder that start screen using live tiles and make it your own. Another thing that you can do is theming. And this theming goes across the entire product and also filters down into third-party applications. The applications that you're working on can completely utilize this to make their applications bigger and better. Pardon me. By default, out the door, you have light theme and dark theme. But on Windows Phone 8, you have a whole plethora of accent brushes. You have multiple accent brushes. I think you have 20 canned accent brushes coming out the gate. And depending on what provider and manufacturer that you have, you may even have more than this. So here's a breakdown of sort of the colors. These are the default shipping ones that come out the gate. And then depending on who your manufacturer is, they may have added two or three. They don't really remove from this list. But here's the red, green, blue values. You can find this all up on windowsphone.com as well as which phone these are going to be available on. These are really important things to test against. So the visual themes filter down into your applications in a lot of ways. All the default controls that you're going to be provided with to design your applications with, whether that be buttons or checkboxes, radio buttons, all of them take, whether it's light theme, dark theme, and most of them put the accent brush in it too. In addition to that, the live tiles that are on the start screen use alpha composite. They're PNGs with an alpha channel in them, allowing you to overlay them over the default accent brush. This allows you to make your application feel very much like a default application on the start screen that you saw here. There's tons of applications with icons. These are PNGs with an alpha layer around them, and you can see the accent brush coming through there. A couple of theme how-tos when you're working on these. Always check your apps in light theme or dark theme. I can't say how many times I've designed an app and it looks really beautiful, but I've been working solely in Photoshop on the dark theme, and then I've been testing it on the device solely on the dark theme because that's my personal favorite. As soon as I switched to light theme, I realized the developer or myself had hard-coded some of the text to actually be white text sitting on a black background. As soon as the background becomes white, that text just disappears. Make sure that even your text in the front ground as well as your backgrounds are using theming and they'll both inverse properly. If you are utilizing the system's themes, use a basic color scheme. Most of our colors that we picked for Windows Phone are pretty bright, vibrant colors that really pop out to the user. If you're competing with those in your own application, because the user can define which color that they have on Windows Phone, you never know which color is going to work with yours and which colors aren't. So we would like to encourage you, if you're going to go big on our accent brushes and our themes built into Windows Phone, then use your basic color scheme in your application. Also, don't be afraid to use accent brushes. They are a simple way to make your application feel very native to Windows Phone 8, as if it was an application developed in-house in the design studio and shipped out globally. People really love it when your phone feels like a part of the entire ecosystem. Another thing to point out in the visuals is the iconography. I mentioned this a little bit in the last section, but some actions are very difficult to clearly convey with text and imagery. In these cases, use really simple geographic iconography instead of images or even text. Now, here's an example of this. In the past, Microsoft and other companies have been very known for very lush, plentiful, full-color graphics and icons. But one of the things you'll notice if you look over here on the right-hand side is that the more simple you get, the more generic an icon the meaning of that icon can be. So if we look at this house, this could be one specific house in the world, maybe two or three. If you look at this one, this might be a couple hundred houses in the world, and this house over here, as it begins to get simplified down, could probably stand for a couple thousand houses in the world. As we begin to remove items and elements and break it down to its basic shape, this icon right here could basically stand for almost 90% of the houses in the world. When we design our icons, we are thinking about worldwide adoption and scale. We're thinking that when this application shows up in a different country, we still want them to know what clock this is. This is the global clock. This is not a specific clock at that time. So the next thing is imagery on Windows Phone 8. Windows Phone is a big fan of imagery and how you incorporate it. We do it in the OS all the time. On panoramas, we have them in the background. In lists, we have them prominent in the tiles. We have them prominent also in live tiles, as well as displayed in full display on lock screen. Imagery in your applications can be used basically to your best interest. You can do them in multiple different ways. You can put them in multiple different ways. Look at the way that we're implementing them on it and kind of follow those rules. I have a couple of simple how-tos when it comes to icons and imageries. With the icons, go simple and geometric, kind of reduce the visual elements and don't do a lot of gradients. But when it comes to imagery, don't be afraid to go big, right? We have full-scale backgrounds. We have the whole lock screen. Make a whole background color. Just make sure you have enough contrast for the content to stand out and pop off of that. We really are a big fan of white space and using the rules of figure and ground when you're designing an application. Layer your imagery with content. So if you have imagery, one of the things you'll notice are live tiles are layered over images. Our panoramas are layered over images. Our lock screen is also layered. So don't be afraid to do some layering. Layer your imagery with content with imagery, and just don't go too deep with it. Here's a personal thing that I've worked on for a lot of it. Export your images to a 16-bit color space. So you won't find this in any of the documents, but this is a personal hint. Windows Phone compresses all of your images from 24-bit to 16-bit. It may look really great in the emulator, it may look really great in Photoshop, but as soon as you get it in, and if it's got a gradient in it, you might start to notice little compression banding. A good way to get rid of that is in Photoshop, Fireworks, whatever your default design program is. When you're saving out a gradient, a background gradient, I just designed an application that had the sky in it, and it had a dark blue all the way to a black gradient in the background. Just add a little bit of noise in Photoshop or Fireworks to prevent sort of that banding where you see the compression happening, and it will look smooth and buttery in the background. It's a good, simple trick to make your imagery and your icon pop when you're designing a Windows Phone 8 application. Next, fonts. These are sort of the default canned fonts that come on Windows Phone. You probably, if you've been working on Windows Phone for any amount of time, you've probably heard of SIGO WP. SIGO WP is our font. It comes in five basic font widths. We've got semi-light, regular, semi-bold, black, as well as light that I don't have listed up there. We also have bundled with it a standard set of East Asian fonts, as well as Chinese standard, Japanese, Korean. They're also included so that you can use those characters by default, and it will do sort of nice fonts and typography for you without you having to embed your own fonts and typography for Japanese or Chinese characters. Developers can embed their own fonts for use within an application. I do this regularly. This is definitely, there's good times to use this and bad times to use this. One, with custom fonts, use custom fonts to showcase your own brand in a very personal and a very positive way. One of the things that works out very nicely on Windows Phone is if your main fonts, here's a great example, the New York Times does this, right? Or this style-dependent font. One of the things that the New York Times does really nicely is they use their font for the headers, but then they use the SIGO for the default body text. Here's an example where they actually use a serifed font and they use it for the title as well as the content. So here's a couple of fonts how to. Avoid using font sizes that are smaller than 15 point. We do all the sizing and dealing with the resolutions when it comes to your applications. If you make anything smaller than 15-point font, it doesn't matter how big the screen is or how high the resolution is, it's going to be very difficult for the human eye to read. So please stick to a 15-point font or larger, and really 17 is also, I mean, it's kind of the real minimum, but 15 is an absolute minimum. If you're using colored fonts, use high contrast colors at small point sizes to enhance readability. So if you've got colored fonts and you got small fonts, small font sizes, make sure that it's not similar to the background color that it's overlaying. If they're almost the same, then it's going to be very difficult to read, especially with the what I mentioned before, the small point sizes, as well as the color on them. Since Sago is an integral part of the UI experience, use alternative fonts sparingly in your applications. Just use them for your brand. Don't go completely nuts with them. Use them with a purpose. And then one of the things that I'd like to point out personally, when you have colored fonts or you're using accent brushes on fonts, make sure that you test your fonts and layouts in both themes. Go to light theme, dark theme, and especially if you have an accent brush, like hyperlinks on fonts, always make sure you test it against a couple of the different accent brushes, especially things like yellow that don't feel as contrasty sitting on top of white. Yellow on white, you can lose the type a lot. So one of the things that I always recommend people when I see typography that's been themed or fonts that have been using the theme color, always check it against all the different theme colors, especially yellow on Windows Phone. Next, globalization and localization. Windows Phone 8 provides a lot of this for you. This is really in the dev details. I can't get too much into this. A lot of it isn't things that I have to deal with in the design studio that much. But bidirectional layouts are totally taken care of, or mostly taken care of for users. We flip the UI for right to left reading, and basically we unflip everything that's like an image so that all the images aren't mirrored and looking incorrect. We also have East Asian vertical text built into those builds. So if you're in Japan or China, you may see some vertical text, as well as localization for strings. So we have built-in buffer space, a room around each of the strings that you can actually swap it out for a different language. One of the rules of thumb, if you're designing, you're an English designer using American English, one of the things you might want to leave like 40% buffer space for all of your typography. Localizing to different languages like German and things like that, some of their characters tend to be a little bit longer than American English. So that completes visuals. Next, we're going to talk a little bit about layout and designing a page. Hopefully that answers some of your visual questions. So first, the biggest question on Windows Phone 8 about layout is resolutions. Windows Phone now supports three major resolutions that you're going to see on the phones in your pockets. One, we have WVGA, which is 480 by 800, which is basically a 15 by 9 aspect ratio. We have WXGA, which is 768 by 1280. And we have 720p, which is HD, basically. And it's 720 by 1280. And the aspect ratio on this one is slightly taller. One of the things to note on 720p is that applications that haven't been converted to this from the old 7.5 applications will actually have a slight black strip up along the top because the applications will sit in the WXGA location on those applications. Next, here is sort of the breakdown of the resolutions and how we handle it from Windows Phone 7.1 in the SDK. So WVGA, which is what we always had, 480 by 800, is a 15 by 9 aspect ratio, and there's basically no scaling, right, that happens. For WXGA, which is 768 by 1280, we basically do a 1.6 scale on it to accommodate for that new size. And 720p, we basically do a 1.5 scale. It's a little bit 80 pixels taller, and you'll be able to handle for that or account for that in your Windows Phone 8 applications. But if it's just a ported over 7.5 application, you'll notice that black strip up along the top. Here's a couple of things to note when you're designing as a designer for multiple resolutions. To display a splash screen for all different resolutions. There are some helpers out there that are great that'll grab the right size images for you. You might want to check out windowsphone.com to see those. Here's something that's actually built into the SDK. To display a splash screen for all resolutions, use a single image file named splash screen image JPEG that's 768 by 1280, and it will handle all the resolutions for you. If you want different graphics for each of the resolutions, do this. Do the splash screen dot screen image dot screen dash WVGA dot JPEG or WXGA and put those all in the root folder. These graphics have to be in the root folder or they're not going to show up as your splash screen. Another thing to note, all splash screen images need to be in the root folder. Just said that. If you can't use a graphic for each resolution, use a graphic for the highest resolution. So this is kind of a rule of thumb. The best case scenario is when you can have different graphics for every resolution. So on the lower resolution graphics, you're not hitting the load and performance of these images that are basically twice as big as the screen or 60% bigger than the screen. And on these large screens, you really want the graphics to pop, right? You don't want the smallest resolution and to actually see some pixelation in there. But if you can't, it's better to fault on the side of actually seeing crisp, clear graphics and images. So get those in there at the large resolution. Next thing that I'm going to talk about is the grid. I talked a little bit briefly about this in the last section when we were talking about design inspiration and composition of a page. And this was sort of generic design principles that we held to very strongly on Windows Phone. But the grid system, this is a great quote by Joseph Mueller Brockman, the grid system is an aid, not a guarantee. It permits a number of possible uses and each designer can look for a solution appropriate to his personal style. But one must learn how to use the grid. It is an art that requires practice. So what I'm going to do in the grid section, obviously I can't take you to art school and teach you everything about using a grid and designing a grid. I have to take it for granted that you did that yourself and that you're already a professional designer and you're really excited about creating a Windows Phone application. But I am going to talk you through how we used the phones and how Jeff Fong and the creative team sort of came up with a grid that worked all across, both from Windows Phone 7 all the way up through Mango and the grid that they're still using. Grid, in a lot of ways, enhances usability too. There was a usability study done years ago, and it was by Ben Gurion at the University of Negev, and it was basically set out some numbers in a grid. And then the next study that they did on those same numbers, they just basically reordered them and then moved one item out of the grid. Just by moving things out of the grid, just that little bit, the usability on it went incredibly down. And so you can highly improve usability on your applications by just by making things seem simple, seem like they're nicely ordered, and it will bring simplicity to your whole app and hopefully streamline usability as well. So here's the phone or the layout for the WVGA screen that we had to start with in Windows Phone 7. We started out by designing a grid and coming up with grid lines. We basically had a wide then thin column and row layout for our grid. This allowed us to create content spaces where we wanted to fill in content. It allowed us to create multiple columns on the grid as well as multiple rows on that grid. All of our UI then would be able to fall into these content areas. But the nice thing about having an even and odd grid like this was that we could have two columns or we could have three columns of data. You could also use four columns or break this up back into the full column thing, and you'll see how this plays out on the UI. Then we would come at screens like the People Hub and everything would fall nicely into our grid. But the grid was also flexible for custom screens like the album artwork. So we put that up against the grid and we measured every single pixel so that everything felt very ordered. These are all very complex screens with lots of different data, but just by adding the order of the grid, it begins to simplify it down. Next, we started thinking about the lists and the way that the lists interacted with the grid. This is with large graphics, and so it's a little bit more straightforward. But as you notice, as our items began to scale down in our headers, everything still fit nicely into the grid that we had defined from the beginning. The next step was kind of adding text to that list, and even more text when it's just completely a text base, they still align nicely to the grid, giving it that order and simple beauty. It started playing out in screens like the start screen, where you notice the lists are the exact same, but they're only just moved over basically one grid column, or two if you're looking at the content containers. And on Windows Phone 7 and 7.5, you saw this play out on the start screen, right? But in Windows Phone 8, we decided to redesign the start screen. We decided to add more live tiles and go from the edge to the edge. But that didn't break the grid. The grid was able to be flexible, and actually our content was able to be flexible to that grid and lay out beautifully and nicely in that grid. So here's a couple of grid how-tos. I can't tell you how to use the grid. You can go online to windowsphone.com and then the design page and download these grid samples. These are all in helpers that you can use for designing your own Windows Phone applications. But here's a couple of quick rules. Use order to create the perception of simplicity. We realize that your application is not actually simple, that you've got data calls coming in, tons of different content, tons of different menu items. But if you put it all in a nice layout using our controls, our system tray, and our app bar, we have put a lot of user research and a lot of work into trying to create a system that will be simple and functional for the user. 2, establish a rhythm and a cadence with your grid. You could go to town and sort of lay everything all over the place, but if you do that, the rhythm and cadence across the entire UI will begin to get broken up, and it will feel like a different application that's not native to Windows Phone 8. The last thing, you can break the grid or bend the grid to make it your content pop a little bit. We do this very little. We do this on the start screen. We do this a little bit on the lock screen, but once you've got a really nice grid, there's an example. I don't want to go into this too much because I don't know what your final UI will be like, but once you've got a great established grid, the best way to make any piece of content is pop it right outside of that grid. All right, so that's all I have for grids, but we'll go on to how this works on the individual layouts and the pages. So I mentioned this before. This is the status bar. Here's your application space, menu bars, and application bar. Now we're going to be talking mostly about this application space. We've already spent a good portion of our time talking about the system, which included like the system tray, the application bar. Hopefully you guys have a great grasp of that at this point in time, and you want to know what to do with your application space or your pages. Firstly, one of the page templates that we provide that everybody seems to love is panoramas. Panoramas are supposed to be expansive and explorative. They're supposed to give you an overview of a lot of different data. It's basically like a giant magazine full-out where you wanted to see all of this different information, and now you can just glance. The actual screen size is only this big, and so you can only see a portion of this. What we want you to feel like is that the screen is actually bigger than just the limitations of your phone, that you can pan through and look at multiple items all at once. Here's a couple of rules when it comes to panoramas. One, when you're working with panoramas, they are not virtualized. So you need to limit all the items that you have in your panorama, or else the performance might go down. You also have background images. So one of the things to remember when you're thinking about panoramas is that they're expansive overview, right? Keep them to 5 items or less. Because they're not virtualized, and that data can slow down really, really fast. So on your numbers of pain, probably like 3 or 4 is ideal when you're working with a panorama. Another thing for panoramas, top level. Nothing but data and navigation. Don't put a lot of controls in here. If you have a timer app that times your running and jogging that you're designing, a panorama is probably not the best place to do it. Also, don't use controls or functionality to move you through the panorama. All of the navigation through a panorama should be finger input. Don't have a button hit over here fire you into a different pane. It's very disorganizing and kind of a jarring experience when it forces you to navigate on a panorama. So top level, nothing but data and navigation. Next, number 3, use a minimized app bar. No system tray. You can use a system tray. We started using one in Office on Windows Phone 8, as well as portrait only. Portrait only is an absolute must. Panoramas don't really work when it goes into landscape mode. They need to be sort of in the vertical portrait mode that you'll notice right here. Panoramas are not virtualized and work best if containing 5 panels or less. Returning users should be taken back to the pane where they left off. This is a big part of the history stack. This is a big part of navigation, but not just when you're using the history stack. If you're on the People Hub on Windows Phone 8, and you leave that People Hub by going to the start screen, navigate somewhere else, and then hit the People Hub again, you will go back to the last pane you were on. It's very important in this experience that we leave them where they are. Sometimes users only use 1 or 2 panes out of a panorama, and we don't want them to be forced to scroll through panes that they don't use. Here's a couple of great uses of a panorama. I don't know if you've seen this. Here's just the visible area, but this is the Facebook application that's currently on the device. And another really beautiful use of a panorama is on the Kindle app today. Their background is gorgeous. They bubble up all the books that you're currently reading, and you can always go search and find more, and I love it. The next is the pivots. Pivots are basically a way to look at a data set on different pivots on a data set. Panoramas are kind of an overview look of everything, where pivots are kind of more of a navigation system, and a visual structure can be used to navigate, to look at different forms on a data, such as in email when you look at either unread or flagged email or brand new email that's just came in. It's all the same data, but it's just different pivots on that data. A pivot control provides a quick way to manage views within the application. Pivot controls can be used for filtering large data sets, viewing multiple data sets, switching applications views, or related content. The pivot control places them horizontally next to each other and manages the left to right navigations with a flick or a pan to the individual pages. Gesturing left and right to the page advances the pivot experience regardless of what controls are on the page. This is another interesting thing to note. Both in pivot and panorama, it's important not to put too much gesture-based controls inside of them. None in the panorama, but in the pivot, don't put a slider control in a pivot, because if you slide left and right on the slider control, you won't be able to pivot left and right. These are basically tabs that go from item to item. Next, pivots are virtualized. So this basically means when you're looking at this pivot item, it's loaded up, and then you load the one to the left, and they load the one to the right. So you can have multiple items in a pivot, and it's not going to slow down on you and get unperformant. So this is a big thing to think about whenever you're designing an application or dealing with technical obstacles, is the performance of that item. Any pivot items outside of this are not loaded up into the memory at all. But one thing to note, you don't want your user to get lost. So the human brain, the reason phone numbers in the US are 7 digits long is because that's what a human brain remembers. Try not to make your pivots more than 7 items wide. You can still get lost even though it'll load in fast, it'll be super performant. Don't put more than 7 items in a pivot just for the human brain's ability to deal with all that data. All right, here's a couple of pivots how-tos. The pivot control should be used only to display items or data of similar type. So don't use it with all kinds of different crazy controls from one page to the other. Use a full page, a full app bar, and then also show the system tray. We always want you to show the system tray as much as possible. The only time it's even a question in our default system is in a panorama. But try to definitely, in this scenario, if you can, use the system tray up at the top so that you know what the time is, that you can show the battery life at any given point. Contain 7 items or less. This is just for the human mind. Never place a pivot control inside another pivot control, or never place a pivot control inside of a panorama control. These aren't meant to be nested. Another thing to note on that, just don't put controls that require gestures inside of them too, because they're going to get confusing to the user. One, they're going to try to be using the slider and the pivot will work, or vice versa, they'll be trying to use the pivot and they'll accidentally hit the slider. Limit pivot header text to a maximum of 1 or 2 words. This is just because pivot header text gets truncated and you don't want to lose whatever that data is. Number 6, never use an edit control within a pivot. That goes back to what I was saying earlier. Just use it for data sets. Drill down to single pages for anything that's got a lot of control in it. Here's a couple of great examples of pivots out there. Nike Plus. It's got the Kinect training in it. This is a completely customized pivot, but it is a pivot control, and you can flip through these items just like a pivot control. They've taken out the headers. They've used big, beautiful images instead of header text, but it's a beautiful, completely customized pivot control, and it shows you the capability of styling and putting your own brand into a Windows Phone 8 application. Next is a Sudoku application. They've kept the header and the title text along the top, but you can see this is also a completely revisited, restyled, different background pivot that's really fun to do. The next thing that I'd like to talk about that the Design Studio at Windows Phone has not talked enough about is just the basic page. We always talk about pivots. We always talk about panoramas. And my biggest feedback when I go on the road and see people designing these applications is that they use pivots and panoramas too much. They stuff controls in them. They stuff pivots inside of pivots. And one of the things that gets frustrating to the user is when the interactions aren't exactly what they guessed they would be. So don't be afraid to use a basic page. A good rule of thumb is if you're in a game, a lot of the times you can use a basic page. Here's a great example. It's like a photo manipulation application, and they've decided to not stick it in a pivot. It would have been very easy for them to put these options in a pivot, but they decided it was much better for the user to have a menu at the top. And then, of course, locally to us, our audio, we could have put this music and all the different options in a pivot or a panorama, but it's just not the correct use. Don't be afraid to use a basic page and just your own design. Our controls are great. They make your app feel like a native application, but you don't have to use them in every scenario. So next, the last thing we're going to talk about is motion and transitions. There's a lot to cover in motions and transitions. I'll try to make it as tangible as possible. But the first thing, let's just talk about what motion adds to your application and what it adds to any application or any ecosystem. Motion delights the user. Motion is really exciting and fun, and it also adds a hint towards what the interaction is. This is a really good way, if there's actually two different hit targets, there's something in motion that we'll talk about, one of the transitions that we call turnstile feather, where we animate the items in one at a time on Windows Phone. This hints at the interaction that each one of these can be clicked separately, and they're different hit targets. Motion gives the impression of enhanced performance. Most of the time, Windows Phone applications load faster than our competitors. Sometimes they're equal, and in other cases, the very rare times, they might even load slower. In those times, we've actually done usability tests against some of our major competitors, and the user still feels like Windows Phone apps load faster because they're never just sitting and waiting for the application to load. It's spinning in. It's the old application is dropping out. And even though it was 0.001 of a second slower than our competitor, it felt faster to the user. And what it felt like is the most important thing. Motion adds personality. If an application bounces in, it feels one way. If it snaps into place, it's a completely different feel. Motion adds consistency. You can create your own motion, but across our ecosystem, I'll talk about the default motion that we put on Windows Phone, and we're consistent with that on the way that it's used, where it's used, how it's used, and it makes it feel like there's real physics involved and that you're living in a real world. And lastly, motion adds elegance. Some may say this is debatable or not, but I think the motion on Windows Phone gives it a little bit of class and it feels awesome. Another thing to point out, said there was a lot to absolve here, or to dissolve. Windows Phone is a movie. But a couple points about this. It's about the content. It's really not about how you got there. And when you're doing animation and motion in an application, an action movie is not 100% action, unless you're Michael Bay. In that case, don't get me started. He thinks it's all about action. But the best action movies are when action is interspersed throughout great points in the movie, right? So we have high, which are defining moments. And maybe this is start screen and lock screen for us. Then we have lows, consistent but not distracting, still delightful. Little moments that they're going to see when they're checking their email day in, day out, day in, day out. And they don't need to be these highs, these big, beautiful motions that are in your face. But they need to be consistent and still delightful. But we don't want them to take up too much time. And then how it is edited is for the biggest impact. Like, how do these motion all sort of work together? Each animation is part of the system, and no animation should stand out as different. Each animation serves a purpose and gets out of the way quickly. That's really important. Animation appears in 2.5 dimensions on Windows Phone. We actually are not using real 3D on it. We're using a perspective 3D, and you can use this in your applications where we basically take 2D objects and we spin them in 3D, which is called 2.5D. We don't make use of elaborate textures, lightings, or extrusions on our items. And for example, the tilt animations don't reveal any depth behind a touch target, only a flat surface. So I'm gonna talk a little bit about how transitions work in your Windows Phone applications. They're triggered by a user action. Transitions provide a mental breadcrumb for the user as they navigate the UI, basically meaning when I hit that back button, I should go to the last point. There was an animation. When I hit it again, I should go to the last animation, to the last animation. They're basically little stop gaps that the user can constantly rely on as the last place. So there's four different ways that you go into and out of a page. There's forward into an app, and then there's backward into an app, meaning you've gone beyond that app and you're coming backward. There's forward out of an app. So first forward into an app, then forward out. And then there is backward into an app, meaning hitting the back button and going in, and backward out of an app. Every single page on Windows Phone's navigations are animated in these four different ways. There's either forward in, forward out, backward in, and backward out. Think about all your applications in those contexts. So here's a couple of rules, actually a lot of rules about transitions. One, establish physics. We do this by forward in, forward out, backward in, backward out. A sense of gravity works on the device that the user can relate to, right? This is the digital world. None of the rules of the real physical world actually apply. So when we started working on and designing Windows Phone, and when you're designing your application, create a sense of the real world, actual physics, actual gravity, things snapping into place, objects having their own weight and size. Gravity is always the same, so should the phone. Transitions are directional, and this is what I was talking about with in and out. Make sure that when you enter, exit, forward and backward, create the mental of mode of where items live. You want them to feel like items exist in certain places, even when they're loaded away. They've swung out of the way to the left, they swung out of the way to the right, but when they click and go back into that item, it's a very subtle thing. Most users don't understand it when they use a Windows phone, they just know it's delightful. If it didn't change, don't move it. So this is a great rule for live tiles. Don't just animate a bunch of stuff if you don't have new data. Same with your applications. Just don't start firing off animations like left and right. If you're doing data visualization, animate them when the data loads in. But if the data is not changing, don't constantly fire animations on those items. Don't like animate the colors from one to another if no data is changing. So here's a couple rules about delighting. One, easing, bring it on. So, I don't know if you can see here, but as this guy comes in faster and slows down as he snaps into place. This is how we do it on the default. It's called a logarithmic animation. If an object is entering the screen, it uses a logarithmic easing, sliding in to a nice, easy stop. Comes in fast, stops really slow. So if that is too jarring, like if you're animating something across the entire screen, use an S-curve. So a motion designer will know these pretty handily in their toolkit, but when the logarithmic easing feels too jarring, S-curve easing can be used for larger moves on the screen. Now, the next thing is when you get rid of it. When you get rid of it, start fast and then slow down. So this is the exact opposite of the others. I don't know if you can pick it up on that screen, but it's the exact opposite. When you're loading something in, have it fly in really fast and snap into place, and then slow down as it snaps into place so that you get an idea of what it looks like. But when you're getting rid of something, have it fly off super fast. This is called an exponential. If an object is leaving the screen, it uses an exponential easing, which builds tension and then quickly flies the object off. Next, here's a couple of the motion basics that we use on the phone, we provide in toolkits, and that you can use. So this is old samples, but it's been the exact same since Windows Phone 7. This is the first one, is called a turnstile. And turnstile is basically when the items pivot based on the edge of the screen and loop to the next item. The next animation is called a continuum. Continuum is when you click something on the list and it carries up and around into the next page. Here comes the name, and it's left this list, and now it's in the title. It carries through one piece of the UI from one screen into the next screen to say, all right, you clicked on Dinara, and Dinara is also now the thing that you're going to see. That's what we call a continuum on Windows Phone 8. Next, there's a swivel. A swivel is basically a dead-end kind of animation. It's used for modals, for dialogues, things like that. If you're coming to select some options, a swivel flips in, and then just as easily when you tap it, it swivels and flips out. So this should be for some very light end notifications, dialogues, these kind of things. Use a swivel in all of these scenarios. On Windows Phone, you may have not have thought about it before, but if you look at the screens, this is how we use it. Next and last, dead-end full-page screens, a slide. When you click on something, the menu slides up. There's nothing beyond that, but just that screen, you can select it and go back, but it basically just slides into place. It's supposed to just feel like it's overlaying the previous content. Now, those were, in the last couple of slides, we were covering transitions. And transitions are basically animations that go from one page to the next. But what about other animations that aren't just transitions in between pages? So animations, visual feedback combined to a local element within a view, but not always as a result of a user action. Mostly, this either has to be based on a user action or data on your screen changing, right? One example is the lock screen's hot motion, which informs the user how to unlock. These are great examples of when you're doing some motion, try as best as you can to hint towards what an interaction would be. As you animate items in and animate them out, animate data in, create a sense of physical space, layer on top of the basic system, illustrate brand and user journey thoughtfully and with purpose, and content is still the focus, not how you get there. So all these animation things are not the goal, they're just kind of the spice that makes it that much better. Make sure your animations serve a purpose. So here is a couple of motion how-tos. It doesn't matter how long an animation takes, it matters how long you think it takes. So the user needs to feel like these are quick, snappy animations. If they're seeing them over and over and over again, they'll get frustrating. Under 500 milliseconds for the human user, it feels instant. So never have an animation that's longer than that. The difference between a really senior motion designer is snappy animations and a really junior motion designer who thinks their work is amazing is these long, slow animations where things kind of fly out and flutter and land on the page. That is too much for the user and it will become frustrating over time. Use easing to your advantage. This delights. This is what I was talking about before. Rather than having something move directly across the screen in a linear way and just stop, have it come in faster and slow down or leave slower and then fly out. But use that easing. Not what you thought you saw. And for time-consuming processes, use animation feedback. So if something's loading, if something is taking too much time, it's very frustrating to the user if they feel like they don't know when it's going to end. It could only be 7 seconds or 5 seconds, but if they feel like it's frozen and it's not happening, it's not giving you any motion feedback, then they feel like it's frozen. Just throwing in a simple progress bar in its indeterminate state or providing your own animation will relieve all that stress for the user. So that completes our composition piece where we talked about the visuals and layouts, the grid systems, and the page templates. Next, we did layout, and then lastly, we followed up with motion and transitions. Thank you very much.